Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, this is Fran Lewis, and it seems that we might have a technical difficulty. I'm supposed to interview the author of Child's Play, and for some reason, the author has not called in yet. And I'm waiting. Going to wait a few minutes, tell you about what's coming up, and we'll decide from there. Okay, on Monday, I have a very exciting panel show, and the panel will be with Larry Farmer, Bruce Coffin, Alan Topol, David McCallop, and Lynn McDaniels, and we're going to talk about voice and point of view. On February 2nd, I have got Brian Freeman, and we're going to talk about Nightbird. The following week, we have the author of Concrete Smile, and we're going to talk about gang warfare, which should be interesting. And on the 13th, an author from Japan, I'm hopefully is going to be on for Vector. And on 2/16, we're going to talk to the author, we're going to talk to David Morrell, John Land, and Andrew Gross about mood and tone. So I'm going to give this another 5 minutes, and then if I have to cancel it out, I will. And we'll see what happens. Kind of disappointed because this is a really interesting book, and it deals with child abuse and schools, and it deals with how what happens when a teacher decides to report that there's abuse in the school, and what happens when the people involved get angry. So we're going to see what happens. I'm waiting to hear from the people that set up the interview to see what needs to be done. And I think I'm going to wait another 2 minutes, and then we'll see what happens. And I'm going to tell everybody that Faces Behind the Stones, Book 5, is in print. And the first three stories will be real stories that really happened to real people, and even though they're behind the stones. And then we're going to talk about other thing would have do story about a bartender and what happens when a bartender doesn't fulfill his responsibility and realizes that, you know, he's going to go to jail because somebody got hurt because he didn't care about the fact that the kids got drunk. Then we're going to try to do one on 21 Shots and several others. I'm going to give this another 3 minutes, and I think I'm going to cancel this out and end the episode and reschedule the author of Child's Play for another time. And let me give you a little background of this book, because this is kind of disappointing. Elle Harrison is well acquainted with the Evans family. Seth is a student in her second grade class, and she's taught both his sister, Katie, and his brother, Ty. And Ty, who has just been released from juvenile detention where he served for killing his abusive father. Now, the thing is, did he really kill the abusive father, or did somebody else do it? And that is the question that we don't know the answer to. I'm not going to tell you the answer to. And I think I'm going to do what I think I'm going to do is cancel so it out and reschedule the show. So I'm very sorry for those listeners that are listening, but I've decided that I'm going to end this episode in exactly 1 minute, unless I hear from otherwise, from the people from Partners in Crime. There seems to be a communications problem. And I could swear this is for, yeah, it was Concrete Smile. And that's the one that she got. That's the one that I sent. And we're going to find out right now when I get an email, I hope, from the people to let me know whether the author is going to call in or not. And I'm getting a word that she emailed the author. I'm going to give her another 1 minute or two, and then I'm going to end it and reschedule this interview for another day. And I really apologize to my listeners because this is not fair to any of you. And I'm waiting. She supposedly is emailing me again. We're going to see what happens. And let me get this done because I will delete this and move it to another day. And this is getting old. We'll see what happens in 6 minutes. She said the author should know that she had to be here anyway. Doesn't matter whether we reminded her or not. And that's just what I'm going to do. Yeah, let's see. No, she doesn't need a pin. She needs to call into the number and press 1. Cheryl, she needs to call 347-884-9045. And I will let her into the system. She does not need a pin. I'll just press 1 to talk to the host. I'm going to give her one more minute and see what happens. Oh, wow. I don't know why she's having trouble calling in. There's no reason for that. I'm waiting. I don't know. I don't know what's happening. She said she's trying and she needs a pin, but that she doesn't really need a pin. I'm going to try to call in on my cell phone and see what happens. This doesn't make any sense. I'm going to call in on my phone and see if I get I can call in. And let's see. 1-347-884-9045. Send. No, dumb. That's not right. 347-884-9045. Send. Let's see what I get. There's no reason why she needs to press 1. Cheryl, all she has to do is dial 1-347-884-9045 and her number will come up on the screen and I will be able to let her into the system. There's no problem with that. I can do that. I don't know what number she's dialing. I have no idea. I have no idea. All she has to do is dial the number. And I'm going to tell her. I don't get why she's having all this trouble. I just dialed in from my phone, and she just probably is dialing it in wrong. I have no idea. And I can't stay on the air with hot, with no air. This is a book about child abuse and schools and education, and I'm asking the author to call 347-884-9045. And I don't know what's happening at this point. But I think at this point I'm going to just tell them to reschedule because it's getting out of hand. And I can't stay on the phone for this. I don't know what this means. I'm going to give it one more minute, and then I'm going to reschedule this interview and take the show out. I don't understand why she's having so much trouble. No one has trouble doing this, ever. And this is, I can't stay on the air for nothing. Well, one of the stories in Faces 5 will be about my grandmother and what happened to her when she was in the concentration camp. And it's going to be in Katie's words, and Katie was my grandmother. And I'm going to see what's happening. And I think this author doesn't understand. Just dial the number. And this is crazy. I can't do this anymore. This is like taking... Ah, here she is. Finally.
Not easy.
Mary, this is Fran.
Hi. Yes. Hi, Fran. I mean, I've been dialing you for 15 minutes. But anyway, we finally got together.
I have no idea. I've been waiting and since like a 1:45, and you don't need a pin. You just dial the number, and it tells you.
I dialed it.
I'll let you in.
I dialed it like 30 times.
That's weird. The 347? That's so weird.
Because
I dialed it myself on my cell phone just now to see if I could get into the system, and it doesn't say you need a pin. Oh, well, doesn't matter. You're here. That's all that really matters.
Yeah, exactly. We finally connected. No, really. I've been calling since 10 hours. So sorry,
yeah, I know.
But whatever. Yeah.
That's okay. I don't know. Sometimes Blog Talk acts weird. This is an interesting book because as an educator myself, I sort of felt really bad. Yeah. I taught for 36 years, and I didn't even hesitate. When it came to talking about child abuse, I did report it quite a number of times. And the scary part was I was never wrong. And a lot of times the students would tell me, or I would notice something, and the worst that would have happened, I felt, was that I would apologize to the parent for being wrong. But I was never wrong, and I saved a lot of lives. So L. Harris is acquainted with
you.
The Evans family. Yeah. You know what? A lot of educators are afraid, but in New York City, where I am, New York State, if you don't report it and something happens, you're liable and you can go to jail for not reporting it.
I think that's true in a lot of places anymore, but I don't think it was true 20 years ago. Maybe I'm wrong, but because you were in the education system then. But I think people have become a lot more aware and a lot more sensitive to it.
Yeah, they are. Like the Joel Steinberg case where the kid was killed for no reason because he was being abused. That was the saddest. So Seth is a student in her second grade class, and she taught the brother and the sister. And the brother's now getting out of jail, and everybody's afraid of him, including the principal, the teacher, and his and then his girlfriend is killed. So how did you come to write this one, Child's Play? The title does fit, let me tell you.
How did I come to write it? Well, I start, L. Harrison is my main character, and she's been in a few other books. So I had written about her on vacation. I had written about her marriage. And now I thought, well, but her career, what about her career? So she is really what led me to the school situation. And then there are issues that I'm concerned about in every one of my books that I try to bring out another issue besides the mystery itself. And in this case, it was the juvenile detention system, a little bit about that, and child abuse. So those were the issues that I was trying to incorporate into the story.
Well, you did, and it was a very powerful story. And the twist at the end was fantastic, but I won't say anything about that. So Elle Harrison is the teacher, and how did she become like an amateur sleuth in this particular book? Which, you know, so you got her as an educator, but you also have her as sort of like solving murders and mysteries. How did you combine those? That was interesting.
You know what? She, again, in every one of my series, I don't use sleuths, I don't use detectives, I don't use private eyes. My people are regular people. And I guess with the readers have a willing suspension of disbelief. They know that normal teachers don't walk in to murders all the time. But my whole thing is about people facing the unexpected and what they do when they walk in. When they're slammed in the face by the unexpected. So I don't intend her to be solving crimes. I intend her to be living her life, and she walks into something unexpected. And so in this case, she walks into the principal's office very early in the book and finds the principal murdered. So she doesn't choose to be in the position of a crime solver. She just happens to find herself surrounded by sometimes dangerous situations that she has to react to and help solve for her own survival.
Well, she also has a personality disorder, which I found very interesting, because out of a while she zones out a lot.
She does.
And that's even scarier.
She does.
So she has dissociative disorder, which, if you watch the news, some people sound like they have it also. yeah, seriously.
Yes.
And I've dealt with that, too. I've dealt with bipolar in school. I've dealt with ADHD. I dealt with autism and everything. So how would you define that, and how would you define that related to Elle?
Okay. First, let me say, I bet you've seen everything in your years as teaching because you've dealt with a population that's ever-changing and broad. So you've probably seen everything. In Elle's case, she has a dissociation disorder. It's fairly mild. But what it is an involuntary escape from reality, characterized by a disconnection between her thoughts and her consciousness and her memory. So what happens is, especially when she's stressed or in danger, she will zone out. It's not voluntary. It's not the way you might say, okay, I'm going to close my eyes, count to 10, take a deep breath. I'm not going to pay attention. This happens to her as part of her disorder. And in general, it doesn't interfere with her life, except that when she gets into situations with murders and attacks and so forth, she becomes prone to more of these. Again, it doesn't always happen to her. There's a situation where she's climbing high and she has a fear of heights. She doesn't zone out then. She kind of, you know, is shaky, but she doesn't really go into a dissociative state. But it does happen without her control. And 2% of people have this, and most of them are women. In fact, half of adults in our country will have at least one episode of depersonalization in their lifetime. It's related to trauma. It's related to, when you have a trauma, let's say you're in a big car accident, you may not remember. Yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And
that's okay. I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know. You're right. You don't remember, or you don't want to remember.
You get kind of detached. You get a numbness, maybe a memory loss of a specific. And that's one reason eyewitnesses are kind of unreliable, because when they see something that's traumatic, they may not register all the memories, or they may remember it falsely. In the most extreme form, dissociation is multiple personality disorder, because you go away from one thing and you're actually becoming walled off from one personality to another. But there's also something called dissociative amnesia, where you'll forget specific events or your own identity or your whole life history. That can last years or just a few hours. But this is a very mild form of dissociation, because she does function. She does have a career, and her friends tease her about it, but she also lacks credibility with them because of it. They call her pulling it out.
I know. She's unique, but she actually cares about the students, and she actually loves what she's doing.
And oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, what gets me is that she comes to school to prepare her bulletin boards, which we all know, those are just so much fun to do. Yes, we do. And the principals, yes, they check everything. Oh, my God, yeah. And her special areas, I know, and the desks and the cupboards. I taught sixth grade for quite a number of years. And then I taught first grade, and that was like shock treatment, because they told me the first day of school that there was a new person coming in, and she had more seniority than I did. So I taught first grade, and then about a month into teaching the first grade, and I loved them, they were okay, they were cute, they asked me if I wanted to take back the sixth grade, and I wouldn't desert my little munchkin people. And I just felt that would be, you know what happens when you teach sixth grade, and you're really good at teaching reading? The little first graders at the end of the year reading fourth and fifth grade. And that's what happened.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they got the full dose of, guess what? They even learned how to use a Thorndike-Barnhart dictionary, the real one. And they were bright. So I taught them for quite a while. Then I taught classes with learning disabilities. That was even more gratifying. So as she's going into the building, what is so foreboding about this building? She's looking at it, and it's like she's thinking, maybe I shouldn't walk in. How come?
Well, the thing is, part of it is just simply trying to set the tone for the book. If everything were going to be, I could have done it that she's cheerful and she's walking in and boom. But I chose to make her sense something uneasy and build on that, because she's hypersensitive. And the thing is, there's really objectively probably nothing about the building that's frightening. What she decides, what she tells herself, is it just looks so stark because there's no children there. And she's never really looked at the building before. But it's really a device to set the tone so that the reader knows, oh, this isn't going to be a light comedy book. We're entering into something.
Definitely
that's
not.
Be...
I know that when I set up my classroom, I always, you know, hijack some of my students from before to help. And up until this last principal, we were allowed to bring them in to help us set up the room and work and do whatever and treat them to McDonald's afterwards or whatever they wanted.
Right.
So, yeah.
My kids' teachers
I
used to do that too. Yeah, it was always exciting when they were invited to come in and help. It was a big deal. And the McDonald's
was a
big
deal. So then we meet this guy who's kind of mysterious and kind of elusive, and he's Stan the janitor. And tell us about, he's interesting. He's a cool character, let me tell you. He's scary, too. Whoa.
He's scary in a way, but then again, he's just always part of the woodwork in the school. He's a guy who's been the janitor forever, and he doesn't interact. He's probably very shy, or who knows, but he, because he doesn't make eye contact, he does his job very well, but he doesn't really interact with anybody. So when things start to go haywire, Al begins to wonder, is he involved? Because what do we know about him? Really nothing. She doesn't know if he's married. She doesn't know if he's kids. She doesn't know where he lives. He's been in the background of her life or her career for, how many years has she been there? 14, I forget, something like that. And now she realizes she doesn't know, and he makes her very uneasy. He just appears silently. He doesn't make noise. He's just always somewhere in the corner watching. So she becomes uneasy about him.
That's well, now we get to the bulk of what's really happened in this novel. What happens when she's curious and she happens to walk in to the principal's office, and what does she find? She goes to the principal's office, she sees the lights on, and then she tries to go outside, and she reacts to seeing this person. What happened? And then they're not exactly thrilled to see her out there, and they think maybe she's the reason why it happened. That's even scarier.
Oh, you mean when she finds the principal dead?
Yeah, the principal's dead, and there are a lot of people,
right,
you know, out there don't think that this is really going to happen and you can really do this, although there are some principals that are really horrible, but seriously speaking. So
yeah.
What happens when she's really not sure, but she sees
well,
this
she
dead
kind
body?
Of, she just kind of, I mean, you can imagine.
Yeah.
She gets terrified. She starts freaking out. And the first person she bumps into, she's afraid the murderer is still there. She doesn't know where to call, what phone to use. She's just not thinking straight. So then she sees Stan, and she wonders, oh my God, did Stan the janitor kill the principal? Because he's just there. So what she does, first of all, Elle is she's an unreliable narrator. We see things through her eyes, but because of her disorder, partly, and because she's half the time in shock, we really can't take everything she says literally. So we know she didn't kill this person, but we also know that because she's there, and she's so unclear about what's going on, people might well want to talk to her about it. I don't think anybody really thinks she killed the principal, though.
Well, why would you describe the principal? She was not exactly the most warm person in the world. So, you know, you don't want her to be dead, but yet you know that she's not exactly going to be missed. And that's even scarier. So
she was kind of a bully.
How would you describe?
She was a bully.
She was horrible, yeah.
Yeah. She intimidated kids who didn't kowtow to her or behave. Instead of using positive reinforcement or setting a tone of teamwork and positivity, she was somebody who would punish and intimidate, and she just was not attractive as a person at all. So as you said, you wouldn't want to kill her, but you certainly could understand when somebody did. She bullied the
little kid. Yeah, I can understand that. I can seriously understand that. So, but she didn't want to call the police. And the police, what does she debate about calling? Staying at the scene, and she gets scared very easily because she meets Detective Stiles and he questions her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a cut character, and then she seems disoriented. So why does she get so upset? But yet she was doing the right thing. She had to report it. She could not report
absolutely.
It.
Right. No. She's been through. This is alluded to. Her husband was murdered a couple of years before, and Detective Stiles was the chief detective in that investigation. So she has a history. In that case, she was, it was her ex-husband. And so she was a suspect. And so she really is shy of talking to police or getting involved with police at all, because 2 years before, having been suspected of murder, then calling in another one and having the same detective to deal with, you could understand how she wouldn't be thrilled to enter into that that interaction.
Well, she's got her friend. She's got a group of friends too.
Yes, she does.
And they're not happy with. They're not happy with her. Her lawyer tells her, "Why did you talk to the police without a lawyer? I mean, wouldn't it make sense that she just, you know, you report a crime? I guess you don't think that." And she doesn't fight back, and she just sort of goes along with that. How come? I mean, she's got guts to do what she did, but still.
How come she does what? How come she talks to the police, or how come she does?
How come she didn't tell the lawyer that I did the right thing? She just says to her, "You're right." She doesn't fight back. She just says,
"Of the history,
yeah."
Because Susan is the attorney, her friend who's a defense attorney, and Susan has been drilling into her for a few years now, and continues to, even if you haven't known about the history, that nobody should talk to police at any length without being represented by an attorney, because that's what she does. And she's seen things go south so many times, she just believes, as a defense attorney, no, the interaction between anybody and a police and the police should be through or with an attorney present.
That's true. So you told us about Charlie, but she sees his spirits. That's scary.
Sometimes, yes, she does. Well, it's not really scary. You know, if you've ever lost somebody that's really close to you, you kind of still see them, still talk to them, still feel their presence. Mm-hmm. And so she may be a little bit more literal than that, but she's still, you know, within the realm of normalcy there. She does not want to let go of him. Even though they were getting a divorce, she still loved him. And so when he was killed, when he died, she just clings to his memory. So, yes, she does imagine him or picture him. And she does imagine what he'd say to her. And in a way, I think it's comforting to her rather than scary.
I understand that, because my sister died a few years ago, and ever so often when I get frustrated,
sorry,
I say to her, like, why aren't you here to solve this problem? Why am I solving all of the problems with all of your grandchildren and children? Why am I doing it?
Yeah. Do you sometimes imagine what she would say to you? I mean, I do that with my dad.
Yeah.
I know. I can picture what he'd say to me. And I'm probably wrong, but I still can understand why she keeps him in her life. Because she's kind of scared
Marshall
without
too,
him.
Yeah, she sees Mrs. Marshall's body, too. And what is the significance of that? That is scary. Like, you see the dead body in front of you after she's dead.
Yeah,
she's
troubled by it. That's more of a haunted memory. It's like, that was so awful, she can't rid her mind of it, and it just appears in her, you know, in her mind. You'll look at something, and for a second it'll take the form of something else because you have it in your mind. It's kind of just a trauma, the effect of a trauma.
Yeah,
that she sees her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can identify with this next question. The first time you walk into a classroom and you see your students, you know, they're there and they figure, oh my God, let me see who I can test the teacher this week. And so she meets her class for the first time. And why did they question her about the murder? I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah. Excuse me. I keep getting a frog in my throat, so excuse me. But the thing is, school was delayed opening for several days because of the murder. The school was a crime scene, and so they couldn't have the little kids coming in and stomping through the building while they were still doing investigation and stuff. So they postponed it for a few days. And all the kids knew by then what had happened to the principal, that she'd been killed. So what Elle does is, instead of having them whisper to each other and exaggerate and have their fears exacerbated by stories that are going around, she has them talk about it, because she really feels that the best way to deal with whatever's going on for them is to face it. So she has them ask questions, she answers them. She tries to allay the rumors that have been going around, which some of which are real gruesome or, you know, boogeyman-ish. And so she tries to tell them the truth and assure them that they're safe, that nothing's going to happen to them. Because that's what the kids need to know when something horrible goes on in their lives. They need to know they are safe. And
this
I'll tell
is,
you
this
what,
is
Fran,
true. And the kids ask
everyone,
some really, very, very good questions. So when she's incoherent, when her friends become concerned about her for missing school the next day, what happens that makes them realize that she's zoned out and that she was upset and that she's talking about when she was raped?
Oh, that's not the next day. That's like later. Right?
Yes. How does she react to the kids when she sees them for the first time? How do they, after she answers their questions and everything, how does she feel about them?
Oh, she loves the kids, and she's very protective of them. And that's why she wants to reassure them that they, in fact, are safe. I think it helps her with her disorder to focus on them and to be not in her own head and in her own life. She's involved with the children. And so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but she really is a very warm person when it comes to the kids. They're her priority.
She's very, very involved. She's creative in a lot of sense, too. And when things get kind of difficult in the classroom, she comes up with some kind of original projects for them to draw, very telling.
I forgot. Yeah, that's what you were talking about. Yeah,
yeah,
she does. She has them draw so that they can get out and express their whatever's on their mind. If they're afraid, they can draw about that. But she asks them to draw their families, I think, again, because she thinks that will be reassuring and make them feel stable. So for most of them, that's helpful. It distracts them from the...
Tell us about Seth. Yeah. He doesn't really talk. He's kind of quiet. And she sees that there's something wrong. Yeah, she sees that there's something wrong, and then she realizes finally that something is wrong. So what happens when she decides the brother comes, and what happens when she decides to take action? That's pretty much one of the cores of this novel.
Yeah, Seth is the brother, the little brother. You said that before, but just to make it clear, his brother is the young man who's just been released from juvenile detention, and Elle was his teacher when he was a little boy, too. So she has a special, she pays attention to Seth a little more than normal because she knows his family has been torn apart by the horrible events that sent his older brother to jail. And she knows his mother's somewhat of an alcoholic. And she knows the whole family history. So she's watching him, and she also has a feeling that she let the older brother down when he was in her class, because maybe if she'd have paid more attention to him, the crises in the family wouldn't have gone to the extreme that they did. So she has a special affinity for Seth, and Seth is very quiet. But when everyone is asked to draw their family picture, Seth draws a very disturbing picture. So he's not like the other children, and she really has an eye on him. And you asked me specifically about what event? I'm sorry, I forgot.
What happened? He is very quiet, and then it seems she realizes that something is wrong, and then Ty comes to the school, and then Katie comes to the school to pick up Seth.
Katie's the sister. Yeah.
Senses something that's not right there. So what makes her, you know, look into it, and then what happens when she realizes that something is wrong? What happens after that? She reports it.
Yeah, she reports it. She sees bruises on Seth's body, and so she's thinking he's being abused. So she does report it, and so the authorities come in and remove him from the home immediately. They remove both minor children from the home immediately. and his sister being the other minor. But the only person Seth does talk, he talks to himself, if you remember. She asks him, who are you talking? The kids are making fun of him because he's talking to nobody. So he says he's talking to his dad. And again, which is another, because Elle has been talking to her ex-husband who's dead, and now little Seth is talking to his dad who's dead. I think it touches her in a special way because she realizes how deep that loss must be for him. More than what, and then compounded with what he says his dad is telling him, which is quite disturbing with respect to the crimes in the book. But I think she has a special feeling for Seth. She feels responsible for him especially.
It's scary that he feels that. And then the sister, just meeting the sister and the brother is scary enough. And tell us about Ty and why, for some reason, he tells Elle that she's the only one that he could trust that ever really cared about him. So why does he attach himself to her out of nowhere?
That's
and
why.
she becomes a little bit leery of the fact that he's so close to her all of a sudden.
Yeah, he's kind of... He's been in juvenile detention for, I think, 8 years, 7 or 8 years, and he's released because he's 21. Or when they get to be adults, if you're in juvie, you get released, at least in Pennsylvania. So he comes to see her, partly because of the coincidence that his brother, is also her student, but partly because he remembers her as having faith in him, as being positive influence on him. When all through school, his teachers had picked on him for being a behavior problem. The principal had actually dragged him by the collar, shouting at him and challenging him to obey her or face the consequences. She'd been kind of physical with him. And Elle knows that in his family, there was abuse. His mother, as I said before, is an alcoholic, and his father was abusive. So he came to a point where his father and he had an ultimate showdown. The thing is, when he's looking back, he says when he was in juvie, the only person he could remember who really believed in him was Elle. And as a teacher, you might be able to realize that sometimes a teacher is the one person that a kid can rely on or feel close to. So that's who Elle was for him. And he comes back to see her right after the principal has been murdered. And the principal and this boy had a very horrible relationship years before. So, you know, having been sent away for murder, now this boy is back. And Elle can't help but wonder at the coincidence that now that he's back, the person who'd been so mean to him is suddenly murdered. So the fact that
It's a big deal. It's a big deal, yeah. So tell us about the new principal, because he's, like, really not that great either. I know. He's like, will you wake up and realize that there are children that need your attention, that you need to listen to her? It's like talking to a hot air balloon with no air. It's scary.
Yeah, he's completely a doofus. He's just appointed at the last minute because the principal is no longer, and they need somebody, and he's got the credentials, I guess. He's got the education.
Yeah.
So they just appoint him. I don't think he's meant to be permanent, but they get him for at least the interim until they can find somebody else, and he's completely baffled. The kids are running rampant over him. He doesn't know how to handle them. Yeah.
It's scary.
He's
I know.
Not a bad
I was
guy.
The,
he's just kind of.
No, he just doesn't have the spunk to be tough. And those of us that are tough, you know, need to give him a couple. I was the dean besides being the assistant to assistant principal. And had my mother not been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I probably might have left the school and definitely gone to another school and help run it. But I must have done something right because my students are on Facebook. And ever so often, yeah, they are. If I wish them happy birthday or what's up or how you doing or I'm proud of you or something like that, I've gotten notes saying without you I would be nothing. You really made a difference in our lives. Our families love you. It makes me feel good because there's a whole lot of them on there. And fortunately, I might have been tough, but I was doing it because I know that they had potential and there was no one that I was going to allow to turn out to be nothing, which is great.
Right.
And that's how Ty feels, like no one cared about him. I'm nothing.
Right.
No one matters. And then he takes it out on her and thinks that she doesn't care. But she's more leery of him for other reasons. So now we meet...
For other reasons.
Jerry.
Right.
Yeah.
Jerry.
Now we meet Jerry. I don't like Jerry.
Jerry. No, you're not supposed
Jerry.
To like Jerry.
But, oh, good. I don't like
but
Jerry.
But I'll tell you what. Jerry, just between you and me and anybody who's listening, Jerry is based on an actual person. My husband and I My husband and I sold our house. We downsized a couple of years or a year and a half ago. And one of the realtors that we ran into, without being a bad guy, but just the personality of Jerry is Jerry. I mean, by another name. He's just a really difficult person. So,
yeah, I know. I've met people like that. What can I say?
Really
yeah.
pushy, really just, yeah.
So,
but,
I mean, she befriends him. Why? Why would anybody want to be friends with him? He's like, he likes her.
Well, she doesn't really like him. She wants to sell her house. And because it was a house that she shared with her ex-husband, and she thinks that by moving she'll rid herself of some of the memories and the dependence she has on him, even though he's gone. So she thinks it's time for her to move on, and she should start by selling the house. And that's how she meets Jerry. And he's annoying, but she doesn't mind him that much as long as he gets the house sold. But he becomes smitten with her. So then he becomes a pain.
Yeah, even when she takes the house off the market or she doesn't want, well, not sure, he still goes in because he has the lockbox key. And even when she tries to not let him go, this guy is like, she needs a good bodyguard, poor thing.
Yeah,
so.
He's invasive. He's actually, it's not allowed for him to go in without her permission.
That's what
I don't even know if it's legal, but he's a very pushy dude, and he's a problem.
Yeah, I know that from my brother-in-law sold this house, and I know that they have to tell you when they're coming in. They have to tell you what time,
absolutely,
so that you're not
absolutely.
There, and then they have to make sure that they walk around with the person so that they don't take anything they're not supposed to. Well, go any place they're not supposed to. So,
right.
Ella's going to deal with all of this. Do you find that her personality needs to be a little bit stronger? And tell us about Jen, Becky, and Susan. They're great friends, though. At least she's got people that watch her back.
Well, Elle is not as weak as she is. As she comes across, I mean, she does tell him to leave. She does get the locks changed. She does face him and tell him, we're done. It just, she stands up for herself, but only in a mild kind of, she's firm. She says what she wants to say, but she's not aggressive. She's very aware of her own vulnerability and her condition, and so she's very tentative in every step she takes because she doesn't really trust herself, given her disorder. So she's cautious and she's careful, but she does not tolerate his invasion of her privacy and his aggressive pursuit of her. She does try to do what anyone would do to stop him. But as a character, she is kind of very cautious in general. As to her friends, they're so aware of her condition. They have a name for her dissociative disorder, and they call these episodes as she's pulling an L. She's not listening. She's pulling an L. So they are looking out for her a lot of the time, but they also, it also has a, it backfires because sometimes when she has an experience, I don't want to go into it too much because I want people to read the book, but when she has a bad experience, they kind of wonder, well, did that really happen? Or did you drink too much and kind of pull a big L and imagine or exaggerate or invent this memory? Because they see no physical evidence that this memory has actually occurred. So they're hesitant to take her at her word because of her disorder.
Okay, that's interesting. So every time she got stuck, tell us about Joyce Huff. And she did too. And at the beginning of the story, she was really very critical. And she has this room that I would decorate when I taught first grade. And she's very organized and traditional, Joyce Huff, and her kids probably fall asleep while she's teaching. So why did somebody go after her? Poor Joyce.
The thing is, Joyce is kind of the nemesis of Elle. Elle is kind of very creative and very free-spirited in her classroom. And she has multiple colors and designs, and she has places where the kids can hang up their favorite projects. And she has mobiles from the ceiling, and it's just kind of, as Joyce Huff described it, it's like a Crayola factory exploded in her room. Joyce Huff, on the other hand, believes that seven-year-olds need order and consistency and reassuring surroundings. And so she has her room very ordered and very muted colors, and her borders are all consistent and the same. And so it's very conservative compared to Elle's very extreme design. And so Joyce, being older than Elle, comes in and just rips her for being such extreme colors and disorganized compared to her room. She says, you're going to mess the kids up. They need structure. They need conservative. They need safe. And your room is just helter-skelter. So why would somebody go after her? When you find out who's going after her, it becomes clear why. But but it's just that she's a victim in the school. In the beginning, it seems like people in the school are in danger, people working at the school, because first the principal and then Mrs. Huff are killed.
And who's going to
be
next?
You don't
know.
Yeah, it goes beyond.
Yeah.
That's right. And so all of the teachers, Elle and her friends who teach there, are also frightened.
And the parents are frightened too, yeah.
Absolutely.
I know. I've been in, you know, tough situations, but fortunately, you know, I'm tough and nobody, you know, tried to kill anybody in my school. Although after I left, they did try to do that to somebody else. Somebody shot something through the window of the principal for whatever reason. And she was lucky she wasn't standing there. Unfortunately, she's still there. She's not the nicest person in the world either. She makes Mrs. Marshall look good, let me tell you.
Oh, my goodness.
It's sad,
The thing is that, unfortunately, incidents like this are not that far from what has gone on in
public schools.
And while these are targeted, specific crimes in the book, and they go beyond the school, they really do resonate because we read about similar situations too often.
That's true. I mean, I was the dean, and the principal called me in one morning, and she said, you need to handle this situation of two students fighting in the supermarket on Sunday. I said, that's not my job. This is after school. They call the police, and the parents deal with it. And unfortunately, I got stuck dealing with it. I said to her, this is not my domain. I can handle anything. I've handled the police. I've handled the ER. I've handled 911. I handle everything. But these two parents have a problem, and their students have a problem. One is a very nice kid, and the other one was kind of dangerous. I said, and it's not my job to report it. I had to report it to the police, and I had to deal with it. And I'm saying, like, and I have to take a witness statement and everything from the people in the supermarket. And they're like, this is ridiculous.
Oh, my goodness. So that's crazy.
Yeah. I got to the bottom of it because my questioning skills, they said, were really good. But I didn't feel it was my place to have to deal with it. So why does the detective, every time Detective Stiles calls her in when there's a murder or something, how come he doubts her? I mean, really, this guy, you know, get with the program here. He's a good detective, but still. He doesn't exactly trust Elle. How come?
No. Well, as I said, they have a history. And he was very suspicious of her role in the death of her ex-husband. But it's not just that. I think he senses there's something off about Elle. And there is. So as a detective, he's really zooming in on her because he's trusting his instincts. And that makes sense that he would.
It does. It does make sense. I mean, I could see where she acts a little strange, and she was a little taken aback by, you know, just the first incident. She was afraid to even talk to him. She sort of clammed up. So, you know, let's get back to
what she knows.
I like Ty. Yeah, she knows.
Oh, yeah, I do too.
I like Ty as a character. So he claims that she cares about her. He cares about her. She cares about him. So why does he walk away from her several times? He gets mad at her. She doesn't exactly do what he says.
Yeah, and also she kind of tells him to stop hanging around her house and stop, you know, to back off a little. He's giving her the creeps a little bit. But there are a few times, I'm trying to remember all of them, that there's a time when he comes to her house and walks in, and because the door's open or whatever, and he's just popping in too often, showing up too often. Is there another time? I mean, there are other times, but mostly he's crowding her, and she doesn't know for sure, because of the murders going on, what his role is. So she wants some distance. She doesn't want to be... Go on.
There's a secret there. We can talk about that. There's a secret that he's keeping.
Yes.
There's a secret that he's keeping, and there's someone else that we're not going to talk about because that'll give it away. But why does she feel she reported child abuse and everybody gets mad at her? The mother gets mad at her. She wants to kill Elle. The sister is angry and Ty is angry and poor Seth is caught in the middle. So why does she constantly second-guess herself? Well, she did the right thing. And why does she feel guilty for doing the right thing for Seth? Because I would do the same thing. I mean,
I don't know if it's guilt. I think because the mother sort of attacks her, comes after her, and the daughter blames her for taking... but the daughter's staying with her friend. She's not that unhappy. But Seth is just, his whole world has come apart. So she feels sorry if she's done more damage for him when he's already been through so much. She, by taking him out of his family, has she added to his trauma? So it's kind of a mixed bag. Yes, maybe she's rescuing him, but at the same time, she's also causing more disruption in his life.
So I have a few final questions here. How did you create the final scenes? Those final scene was fantastic. Whoa.
How did you create
those final scenes? Those are, oh my, where the truth comes out, but we won't tell anybody what it is.
Well, it's all set up in the beginning. So it just brought it, the tools that are used at the end have been introduced at the beginning. So it's just a matter of applying them when they're needed. And sometimes you don't do things intentionally as a writer. Sometimes you do things and then it becomes clear as you're writing why. So I can't say that it was conscious. I can't say that I knew it at the beginning that I would end it with those scenes. But I think subconsciously, a lot of work is done subconsciously. And
well, that's true, because
that's part of the deal with writing.
When you write, when I write, I don't think about it, I just write and pray that it comes out right. And that's why I have my editor, Maxine, to fix it when I don't do it right. Or if it doesn't make sense. Yeah. It makes it so much easier.
And that's also why you can revise and so on. Yeah.
So what lets readers know that Elle might be in danger, that her job might be in danger? And Mr. Royal, oh my goodness, are you going to leave him running the school? Oh my gosh.
Well, it's for now. Actually, the whole book takes place in a matter of a couple of weeks. So, oh no, that's not true. It ends up, I'm sorry, but it's a condensed period of time. And she worries about her job, A, because she is concerned that her disorder, her mental disorder, dissociative disorder, may be getting worse, and she may not be able to trust herself to be in charge of her kids, A. And B, she has an incident where she didn't show up at school one day.
Yeah.
So she may lose her job, you know, if she has more incidents like this. So she's a little uncertain, but I think she's determined to stick it out and take control and be in charge of herself and her career.
I hope the children would be very sad.
If the
kids could say something to her, that last thing when she walks in, that was priceless. That's all I'm going to say about that. That would make her understand that those kids really care. And it's great because when children let you know that you matter and that what you're doing matters, it doesn't matter. Money doesn't matter. Anything doesn't matter. When you know that you're making a difference in the lives of these little people, it's great. So what's next for Elle?
Oh, dear.
Is she going to remain in her house and she's going to stay in Logan Elementary School, or is she going to find a different school?
Well, for now, she's decided for now. She's not going to sell her house right away. She's going to take a breather, and she's finishing the year out with her kids. So that's her immediate future. As to her long-term future, we'll just have to stay tuned, right?
That's exactly right. So one final question. Where can we find out more about you and your work? And for those of you that I'm not going to ask the author, like I usually do, to explain the title Child's Play, because it would give it away. I'm not going to let them. They can't. I read it, and I'm saying, okay, I get this. I'm also going to post my review. I always wait till after the show. I'm going to post my review after the show. And if I do say so myself, I did a good job on this one.
I take my time.
I should say that for those people, I just got 5 requests for reviews from people I don't know. And I don't pan books. I don't write negative reviews. And if a book doesn't get at least 4, 4.5 stars, I won't review it. I will seriously just write a summary, which is not the case here, summary for the author, and they could use it for publicity, and I won't post it on Amazon, because what I think is good, someone else might think is bad. And what I think is not great, someone else might think is wonderful. So my job as a reviewer is to write what I think and my critique about the book, but I try not to write anything negative because that's just me. And
well, it's certainly is wonderful that you're doing that, and I know that I agree with you in a way. Like, why pan something unless it's so horrible? But then why even review it if it's horrible? But
I
anyway,
agree with you,
yes,
and that happened. That happened twice. That happened twice. And I did tell the publicist that I wasn't going to review the book because they deserved a 0.5 star. And that's rare.
Ooh. Ouch.
Now, it wasn't anybody from Partners in Crime. It was two other people. And one was because the person was looking up a crime scene, and the crime scene was contaminated. And the author wrote some stuff about the crime scene and who was helping him do it. It made absolutely no sense. So where can we find out about you and your work, and when is the next book coming out?
MaryJones.com, M-E-R-R-Y, Jones.com. That's my website. And as of now, I don't have a date for the next book, but I'm working on it now. And I'll keep everyone posted as soon as I find out.
Well, make sure I get it first, people.
Thank you, Fran.
For those
this
of you
was
that don't
so
know,
much fun. I am so sorry.
Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah, it took so long
you know what?
Sometimes
Blog Talk with the phones gets crazy, and you never know. So I know normally it's okay. We have the hours, and I usually do like an hour anyway, so it's an hour, which is good.
Yeah.
I'm going to be on the air Monday with Larry Farmer, Alan Topol, Bruce Coffin, Linda McDaniels, and David McCallop, and we're going to be talking about voice and point of view. It's one of my panel shows. On February 2nd, one of my favorite authors in the universe, Brian Freeman, will be here. If you see it on Facebook, Nightbird, you want to read it. You probably have nightmares afterwards, but it's great. tossed a book about gang war that took me a while to get into, but when I did, I couldn't put it down. Concrete Smile, one of the wonderful interviews from Partners in Crime, on February 6th. And on February 13th, I'm hoping this works out, Michael Shishko will be calling me from Japan. And I'm doing the show at 8 o'clock in the morning. I don't do shows at 8 o'clock. I'm doing it at 8 o'clock in the morning because it'll be 10 o'clock there. So I'm waiting for the confirmation. And one final, I'm booked until June 20th. But on February 16th, this is a great honor. David Murrell, the creator of Rambo and the Thomas DeQuincy series, Andrew Gross, and John Land will be here to talk about mood and tone in their novels. And that's just some of my little antics coming up. So I want to thank you so much for today. This was fun. And
it was fun for me. Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun for me, too, and I'm glad I got to speak with you. And as an educator, I have
too.
To tell people, you guys need to read this book. It's very enlightening. And for those teachers out there, seriously, that don't report child abuse, even if you're wrong, the worst that will happen is you'll have to apologize to the parent for being wrong. And most likely, if you think something is wrong that's happening, do yourself a favor and the child a favor and report it. Get a registry number from the guidance counselor and go about the procedure, because you know what? You could be saving somebody's life. And on that note, I hope the sun is not out yet. It's still raining. Oh, well, what could you do? From Upper Westchester, I want to thank everybody for listening, and everybody have a nice day and bye.